Mormon Matters Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation and is seeking to build financial support separate from Mormon Stories Podcast. All donations to Mormon Matters are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at mormonmatters.org.
Welcome, everyone, to another edition of the Mormon Matters Podcast. I'm your host, Dan Weatherspoon. The idea to do this podcast came a year ago in April when Mormon Matters had an episode on the marriage between Polynesian culture and LDS culture. And just one of the things that just came up in the natural conversation was sort of a difference in LDS funerals versus Polynesian funerals and the larger place, it seemed to me, that Polynesian culture had for real mourning, real grief being expressed, instead of sort of the neat and tidiness that we sometimes find in LDS culture surrounding death, or to immediately say things like, oh, isn't it wonderful that we have the gospel and we know this person will be with us again, or something like that. They really gave a presence for grieving. And I thought, you know, we ought to just talk about grief and grieving in general. It's such an important thing. So many cultures, historically as well as contemporarily, have this real recognition that grief and grieving processes are important for healthy humans. And so I thought I'd gather a great panel of experts, experts either through education and or the professions that they have, as well as those who are well acquainted with grief, and especially in two cases, currently two people on this panel have recently faced the death of their parents. So I just thought we'd do a nice educational section followed by a more personal section, folding in how we in the West grieve today, maybe places that we can improve what happens, help people feel normal, that there is no normal way to grieve, that the processes aren't standard pass or fail things, but just that idea of opening up room for healthy recognition of loss and things like that. So that's our plan today, and I want to welcome to the show again Jana Reese. Jana, you've been on the most times, probably five or six. Welcome back to the show. Would you introduce yourself to everybody a little bit?
Sure, I'd be happy to, and thank you for having me on again. I wish I could say that I'm going to be my usual optimistic and entertaining self, but if I ever am those things, I'm not feeling it now. As you said, you know, a couple of us have lost parents. I'm one of them. My mother passed away in January, so it's been 6 months. I just passed the six-month anniversary. And it's been a very difficult journey, very, very hard. I'm looking forward to hearing some of the broader perspectives that can be offered here, because I, you know, it's funny, people have sent me books about grieving in the last few months, and I have looked through a couple of them, especially the ones that are short.
Right.
But I found that I haven't had a lot of energy for, you know, thinking about this in a more than just a really visceral way.
Yeah. And you've been so public in blogging. Why don't you let everybody know what the name of your blog is? And you've been sharing a bit of this process with us, and I've really appreciated it. And that certainly is what helped bring you to mind as we planned this podcast.
You know, thank you. I didn't set out to write blog posts about what I was feeling, but I just kind of felt compelled to from time to time because it's been very difficult, or in a couple of cases because I've had periods where it hasn't been as difficult, and that has surprised me too. So it's been interesting to see the response of some readers, some of which happens publicly on the blog or on Facebook, and some of which happens privately when people contact me. And I had one woman, for example, who had read Flunking Sainthood. Oh, by the way, that's the name of the blog, and it's also the name of my most recent book. She had read that, and she said she felt a kind of kinship with me through the book. But then her mother died on the same day that my mother died.
Wow.
And Yes, and so she'd been sort of following this, and I don't think there are examples quite as dramatic, but I have heard from a number of readers that they've appreciated any thoughts on grief because it is such a universal and leveling experience.
Totally. Well, thank you again, and we'll call on you here and there, and feel free to be kind of my co-anchor here as we draw out these experts a little bit on this subject. So always pipe in, please. Lisa Hansen, welcome back to the Mormon Matters podcast. We had you on our show about near-death experiences. Thrilled to have you back here. Would you mind giving us all a little bit of a background?
Hi, Dan. Yes, thanks. I'm excited to be back on. Since I was on, both of my parents have passed away as well. I'm a doctoral candidate at the BYU's Marriage and Family Therapy program and find how much loss has to do with almost, well, I won't say almost all, but a lot of the things that people deal with that cause depression and anxiety are circled around the experience of loss. And death, of course, is a particular kind of loss. It's a loss of people in a very permanent way.
Right. So you'll bring both your clinical and your personal to this podcast, I hope?
That's the plan.
Okay, thank you so much, and we'll look forward to everything you share. Now, Lisa's been a great friend in hooking us up with our other two panelists. One I've met before, and that's Connie Erickson. We've met in person and said hi a few times, passing at UVU and things. Connie, would you tell everybody a little bit about yourself and the background that brings you here to this conversation?
I've been a music educator for a few years, and at some lull in employment there, I thought, what is it that I have always really been interested in? And I picked up on archaeology, and I pursued a degree at UVU and did a few excavations through that and have found a sort of tie between my music background and my love for music and my awareness of how important a role that actual performance plays in life, trying to tie that in to how it's always played a part in life. And that really becomes evident as we study burials. And so my intent is to try and say, how has performance, whether it's dance or music or theater, procession, how has that been expressed in cultures not now living? So because archaeology falls under the umbrella of anthropology, we say that anthropologists study the living and archaeologists try to infer those same things, but from the dead. So it's a way of actually tying in my interest in performance and music in general with the idea that it's continuing and has always played a part. And that always ends in the burial practice. That's where we get most of our information about people's behavior and their beliefs and their ideology. So those things kind of tie in.
Yeah, we're thrilled to have everything that you bring and just cross-cultural and just give us that flavor so that we can kind of locate ourselves within our own practices and things. So thank you so much for that. Connie, one more thing. Are you willing to share a little bit about a performance that you do regularly these days?
I sing with 360 really great friends in the Mormon Tabernacle Choir.
How awesome. So, yeah, ever since I've gotten to know you, it's been a lot more fun to watch conferences. The choir pans on you. And I also know Brian Hales and Cliff Bentley decently well. So it's fun to watch the cameras now a little bit more. So thanks. Great to have you. Yeah, you guys always sound great. Cindy Jones, thanks for coming on. And I just learned something in our little warm up before this, that you are Connie's sister, but you come to this more from a professional angle in what you do for a living. So tell us more about yourself.
Well, thanks, Dan. I'm glad to be here. I'm a late bloomer. I raised children first. I raised six children and a foster child, and I've got two grandchildren living at my home now. And I got my bachelor. I went back and achieved my bachelor's in sociology, and I'm planning on getting my master's at the University of Southern California in social work, but I am right now a certified in grief counseling, so I have my certification. I am glad I'm here. I can do a little education, but I'm sure glad I've got these other three to help me along here.
Great. Well, thanks, and we'll hit you up for some of the practical stuff. And I know that you're a grief counselor for a school district right now, and so especially as we talk a little bit about adults and children and just sort of general schemas for approaching grief, we're going to call on you hard. Okay?
Thank you.
Sounds good. Well, everybody, let's dive in. We pre-circulated a little bit of a plan, and we thought we'd start with an educational section or just sort of a framing of grief and grieving and death practices and sort of attitudes towards those who've passed on. And we'll do it kind of culturally first and sort of how communities and groups of people deal with it. And then we'll still, in an educational section, maybe start to turn a little bit more towards the stages of grief and the individual kinds of processes that are pretty common for most of people when they face a loss. So we'll kind of do that in an educational section. And then we'll turn a little bit more personal both in terms of people sharing their own stories, but also reflecting as Latter-day Saints here on Mormon Matters podcast about things that we see in our cultures and how we're experiencing grief around us as well as in our own lives here as Latter-day Saints. So that's kind of our plan. So Connie, can I turn to you to begin a little bit with just a broad look at the different ways different cultures look towards the presence of the living, or the presence of the dead in living daily life versus, I know some kind of embrace them and they're continually present and they talk about them all the time. Others sort of put them aside, never talk about it, and sort of just how grief plays in a broad way across different cultures. Just kind of some broad strokes to start off with.
Mortuary performance generally is intended, we think, to formalize relationship between the living and the dead. So we kind of categorize or look at three aspects of mortuary performance to analyze how grief plays out in the society. And in the categories of deathbed scenes, you know, at the moment that you know someone's dying or the moment that you hear someone has passed away. And then in what are their customs of burial or how they treat the body. And then, as particularly the aspect you just mentioned, what's their way of memorializing the dead? And in each of those, there's a dichotomy that we can actually trace in Western culture through history of, it used to be everybody dies, it's part of the common experience. You know, if you look back in the Middle Ages, it's like, it's a collective experience. Everyone dies. And then as we got more towards the 12th century, it focused more on my death. What will my future be? What have I done in my life? You know, the book of life concept coming out. And then towards the 17th century, we start to focus as a Western society on thy death or the death of others and how we deal with that. And that kind of has gone through a couple of stages. At first, it was really romanticized and we'd wear lockets with pictures and we'd talk about a good death. And then as we got more towards the 20th century, that changed and became a lot more institutionalized and a lot. And as you mentioned, that we kind of experience in our culture, in our Mormon culture, more it's done. We know what's going on. So let's be on with living. So not only is it a cross-cultural experience, but it's also a evolving experience.
Right.
And when we talk about how we think of people after they're dead, and that's really the period of mourning, we might say, there's this dichotomy of separate or venerate. There are some cultures that believe the dead are unclean, and as quickly and as completely as they can remove them from society, the better. Their names are not to be spoken. They're not to be remembered. All of their belongings are gathered and disposed of, either by burning or by burying or just removing from the society. And it's done. We have nothing to do with them. And on the other end of the spectrum, there's the, well, he was such a good man, I'm going to name my first son after him, and we're going to visit the grave, and we're going to have a service where we talk about them and we celebrate what they did and what they've done for us, clear to maybe the Mexican tradition of Day of the Dead, where once a year we actually invite the dead in a ritual kind of way to be among us and to participate with us. And we put names on candy and we light candles and we take specific foods to the grave site. So that's kind of an overview. It's super general, but we know that those extremes exist in cultures, but also in history.
Yeah. Well, I'm very interested not only in the cultural stuff, but the historical thing. And when you kind of talked about the progression, you know, up until the 20th century and how it shifted focus from the group to individuals to yourself, and then now we're more separated today. Let's leave death and dying to hospitals, hospices, out of sight rather than at home, you know, though we certainly still have the deathbed gathering often, you know, in hospitals and things like that, but it's more antiseptic. But it's also, would you say, at least it occurred to me, and would love to hear yours or anybody's feedback, death is now much more of a defeat. It's a failure on our part that we couldn't keep this person alive. Medical science has helped us think that we are a little bit more immortal.
Exactly. And that gets rather complicated with all of the new ways we have of prolonging life. And so even to the point of what is actually the definition of dead, that's become a real complicated issue of determining when we should let someone go, what part of their body not functioning constitutes their separation or their passing to another place. It is very much wrapped up in medicine and our view of life being where it's at, where we want to be forever, and not maybe as historically or in other cultures recognizing it is an integral part of life to die and to pass on and to move to another state of existence.
Right. I invite anybody else to jump in here. Let me add one more thing, but everybody, query Connie as you will. But another thing, Connie, I know that there's one of the most difficult things in the way things happen today is we'll often have family members that have felt estranged from the person who's dying, and they're the ones who want to prolong the person's life or something in this hopes that they'll have this chance to reconcile. And that's probably just a symptom, too, of our cultural shifts to not living in close proximity with your close-knit family and having those close relationships. Is that a piece of it too? So that, you know, today's dying is often affected by just the fact that we don't talk with each other. We don't spend all the time with each other and it's, we're less intimate with people.
That's true. That was Cindy.
Yeah, very true.
Jump in with anything you have, Cindy, or questions for Connie. I just thought I would throw that out while I was thinking of it.
I think it's a shame that we put death on a back burner and we try to shuffle over it as quickly as we can. And people who, in our culture, they want to help, and for the first little while, they're great. But when the grief really sets in 6 months later and down the road, we're supposed to act differently than we really feel. And I think it's a shame that we can't express more of how we feel and have people accept it.
And historically, was it because there were structures in place that this was handled better historically than it is now?
Yes. Can I jump in here for
please,
a moment?
Please.
Not long after my mother passed away, I published a little article on Huffington Post called "Let's Bring Back Mourning Clothes."
Yes.
You know, it was a little bit facetious because I don't think that full mourning dress as it was envisioned in the 19th century is probably appropriate for our culture. But I'd like to have something, a black ribbon, a black armband, something, so that the checker at Walmart, when I'm spaced out or angry or something, knows that it's not about him. You know, there's something with this lady. Give her some space. Give her a wide berth. I think that some of the customs of mourning that we have lost in our relentless drive to pretend that death doesn't exist in our culture, we have really created almost no space culturally for people to grieve except extremely privately. And I think that's a problem.
Yes. And Connie, can you help us with, because I know that in, you know, the Bible, you hear all this, you know, mourning periods and there were specified times of remembrance and things like that. Fill us in on anything kind of historically that where Jana was talking here, that there was much more recognizing after death has happened, the person as well as the culture. The funeral and the burial and the things you kind of talked about done the culture, but we're kind of now at least playing a little bit in the personal area.
What comes to mind is an attachment, I think, to what Jana just described. And it's a personal thing, so I don't know if it's appropriate while we're... But yeah, Cindy and I lost our dad about 5 years ago. And at the time, my family and I, we were living in Germany. I was teaching school. And we came home on kind of a whim. We'd never come home at Christmas time before. It's just a little cost prohibitive. And on Christmas Eve, our dad had a stroke. And he was in the hospital, of course, intensive care and touch and go for a week and passed away finally on New Year's Day. But it left me in such a personal quandary because I had a job. And because there was no band around my arm, I think that's an awesome reference, I really struggled with the idea that I was leaving everyone who knew what I was going through and was suffering with me and was going to go back into a society where people cared about me but didn't even know my father. I didn't know the first thing about him or that I had gone through it. And it was just very uncomfortable. What do I do? Do I make an announcement? Do I wear a sign? You know? And I chose to go back and on the scheduled time. And I can remember I just didn't know what to do and I said nothing. And the word kind of got out through a friend and fellow teacher there. And I'll just never forget how comforting it was to have the football coach came in my room and in tears. He said, I just heard what happened. He just crossed the room and hugged me. And I thought, you'll never know how valuable that was, that you just took that discomfort away because I didn't know how to bring up the subject. Is it bragging? You know, guess what I just went through kind of thing.
Right. Or is it,
or how can I tell my students? How can I tell my colleagues? How can I tell my boss? How can I tell my community? And I think losing that structure of mourning was personally extremely difficult.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Thank you for that.
The last thing a person experiencing grief wants is to have a lot of attention drawn to oneself. And yet the thing a grieving person needs the most is an appropriate kind of attention. So it's a dilemma that we don't have a resolution for in our society right now, unless we're connected with people who will do the attending and the spreading of the word.
And that's the historical piece we're missing, because we are so quickly around the world, you know. In former times, you were a tight-knit community. You knew each other's business. You were your neighbors, and they knew you, and they knew when you were... someone was suffering, and not just, you know, health, but at death. And I think it was a time of rallying around, and I think the whole community was aware of what you were going through in your household.
Yeah.
That's changed.
Definitely. Well, before we kind of talk about some general grief structure stages, if that's appropriate, normal grief patterns, etc., anything more from anyone on Connie? She brought up things like deathbed scenes, burial customs, body treatment, memorializing, separating, venerating. Anything more on that societal level or practices that anybody brought with them today that they wanted to talk or ask about?
I'm genuinely curious about societies that allow for the wild expression of grief and those that prescribe a more controlled expression of grief. I don't know, Connie, if you have anything to say about that. Maybe that relates to what you heard before, Dan, about the Polynesians, but I'm interested in that.
Connie, anything that you can bring? And again, just draw on general studies or draw on personal experience. And I don't know if it's appropriate to say to add on to Lisa's, is one way healthier than another? Does anybody have any sense on that? You know, I have a feeling we all would want to say, whatever's not exactly what we're doing right now, it has to be healthier, you know, because, you know, yeah, all of us always struggle with this. Yeah. But in general, I'd you know, fold that layer in too, Connie, or anybody else, if you'd like, as well.
My overall sense, and this, you know, this isn't some case study, but it just has so much to do with what we believe that dead person is about. I mean, it goes to the root of our faith. And if we're taught that they're okay, they're better, things are better, then we work really hard to be happy for them. And so I think we shortchange our experience of loss. And I think it's kind of just as simple as that. If you look at a culture that believes they're a different being, they're not, for example, the Hopi, they're not Hopi anymore. They're a different being. Then you don't speak their name and you do move on and you don't have that wild expression of grief. So I think it has to do with what we picture as the overall condition of loss. You know, how universal is it? Does it apply to the person who's passed on? Then we grieve, and we expect that we're grieving for them as well as for ourselves. Maybe that's the difference. Does that make sense to anybody?
Yeah. You know, when, about 4 Christmases ago, Connie and my mother, they were all over in Germany, and I was by myself. Of course, I have my 6 children, but I get a little closer to my mother and my sister. And my dog died. I had to put him down. And he meant a great deal to me. Pet loss is just as traumatic, and you go through the same tasks as you do for a person. Symbolic loss is about the same way, whether it's a divorce or a person who died in suicide. The symbolic losses are just as important. But however, I lost my dog, and I was down at the vet's place, and they had asked me, "Are you sure?" And I said, I can't stand to see him suffering anymore. He's in so much pain. And my husband was with me, and they gave the shot to my dog, and I guess I just let out a wail, a howl, a mourning cry. I didn't know I was doing it. However, everyone in the building knew I was doing it. I just howled, and I couldn't get my breath for a while. I just cried and cried and sobbed just as loud as I guess. And my husband finally looked at me and he said, "I hope you cry like this at my funeral." And I went, "Holy cow, am I doing something wrong? Am I grieving over an animal the way I shouldn't be doing?" And it just, all of a sudden, it snapped me out of it. And I was going, "Oh, yes, I should be appropriate. This isn't appropriate." And I've always thought of that. And I've always went, you know, I'm so sad that I can't let out those howls or those wild moans when people that I love and pets or any loss. Yeah. I feel.
Yeah, and some cultures would allow it, and it does seem like ours doesn't. Jana, kind of heard what she brought up, probably piling on with you. I know that you lost a beloved dog recently too. This is not a good.
That's actually been a while, but yes.
Oh, I remember you writing about that. Yeah. Oh.
Sorry about your loss. You know, that is a kind of grief that I think a lot of people feel almost ashamed to be suffering from. And, you know, it's one thing to break down somewhere and say, "Well, I just lost my parent," or "I just lost my spouse." But if you just have lost your cat, there are a lot of people who wouldn't understand that the feelings are the same, and that there is this terrible. I don't want to equate a pet with a human being, so I want to be careful of my words. But grief at loss is a similar experience, and it takes a long time to get over that sadness. You know, and with pets, I think people who don't have pets will say things like, oh, well, you can get another dog, cat, bird, chicken, whatever, you know, as though they are manufactured items that are done on an assembly line, easily replaceable and interchangeable. And, you know, anyone who loves animals knows that's not the case. Right. Anyway, don't get me started.
No, thank you. Thank you. Well, so anthropologically, I know that, you know, Arnold Van Gennep wrote a book called Rites of Passage, where he first kind of described ritual structures, and his whole focus was on the societal aspect of it. So rite of passage, or the boyhood to manhood rituals, the girlhood to womanhood ones, marriage. Obviously, we have some baptisms and, you know, other things that mark certain rites of passage here. And then certainly he talked about funerals. And the whole idea is to take a society that recognized these as boys or girls, and now they're going to enter the world of adulthood, or these as single individuals, and now they're going to form a family unit. And so he has this nice pattern where rituals and performances are used to help a society, you know, move and recognize a new status. Now, and in the case of funerals and stuff, where, of course, we're talking about somebody who was with us among as the living, they're now with us only as ancestors, or they're no longer with us at all if we happen to be in one of those cultures where we move on and pretty much they either just go into a generic ancestorhood and we no longer think of them as individuals, or we just no longer deliberately think about them. And so we have that whole societal piece, and we've been now laying in the individual piece of it. Is there anything that anyone has to say on that societal piece before we move on to what I think is the next logical section of this educational, you know, broader framing thing, which is individual stages of grief? But anything more on societal transitions that come through ritual? Either Connie, start us off if you have anything, or anybody else.
Well, I want to say don't get me started, because I feel really strongly about that. I think in our society, particularly Mormon society, we are bereft of ritual that help people make these important transitions. I teach junior high, and I think how different it would be if those 12-year-old boys had to put on a glove filled with stinging ants and dance for 4 days until they collapsed. And then they say, I don't need to bow to anyone. Look at what I have survived. I really believe that a lot of the difficulty we have in youth particularly is because they don't have any formal way of saying, I have arrived. We expect them to act as adults, but we don't have any way of marking that they have a right. Like, of course, we have a mission and a driver's license and things like that, but compared to what we see worldwide, it's pretty small.
And so same thing with death. We just don't do it right. Are there elements that you see in rituals around the world when it comes to what goes on at the funeral or during the week-long, you know, celebration of life, marking the passage? What is it that you see that maybe we're a little bit light on when it comes to the funeral is in terms of serving the community?
I think it's a sense of detachment. That's at least my experience when I attend a funeral. You're hearing about this person, and they achieve a sort of notoriety, and you want to participate. You want to say, hey, here's the piece, here's the relationship I had with that person, and yet it's seldom allowed. It's very formal. The structure's established, the speaker, that song, that. And for the 100 or so people who are in attendance, it's a very detached experience. Whereas I think at least the family and they're given a little wider berth as to how they can behave and how they can mourn. But there really is not much room for the community at large to say, right, well, he was just a friend, or He was just a neighbor, and you don't get any chance to say, and this is why that friend, that neighbor, that colleague took a piece of me when he or she passed away.
Yeah, we're bereft of the wake, you know, the go to the bar and tell the stories, the informal, along with the formal rituals that you sometimes see in other cultures. Jana, I jumped on you, sorry.
You know, this concept of holy envy that I think, Dan, you and I have talked about before from Christer Stendahl, where you look at other religions with this sense of, oh, if we could only do this. So yeah. I look at Judaism and say, if we could only mourn like that, if we could only ritualize this experience. My friend Lauren, she was an Orthodox Jew, and then in her 20s, she converted to Anglican Christianity and is now an Anglican priest. And she's written a book that I just ran downstairs to get called Mudhouse Sabbath. There's a chapter here about mourning. The whole book is basically about things that she has learned from being a Jew that she can bring into her life as a Christian. And it starts out, this chapter, she says, "Church funerals, when they tell the truth, not only remember lovingly the lives of the departed, they also preach the gospel. They proclaim that Jesus is risen and insist that those who died in him shall be risen too. What churches often do less well is grieve. We lack a ritual for the long and tiring process that is sorrow and loss. A friend of mine whose husband recently died put it like this. For about 2 weeks, the church was really the church. Really, awesomely, wonderfully the church. Everyone came to the house, baked casseroles, carried Kleenex. But then the 2 weeks ended, and so did the consolation calls. While you, mourner, are still bawling your eyes out and slamming fists into the wall, everyone else understandably forgets and goes back to their normal lives. You are without the church and without a church vocabulary for what happens to the living after the dead are dead. Mourning maybe is never easy, but it is better done inside a communal grammar of bereavement." Don't you love that? "Christianity has a hopeful and true vocabulary for death and resurrection, but it is Judaism that offers the grammar for in between, for the morning after death and before Easter." And so the whole chapter is about specifically what do Jews do to mark this. And it's really fascinating. You know, those first 7 days, there are intense rules for sitting Shiva. You are not allowed to be alone. Everyone comes and sits on low stools with you. It's a very communal affair. Everyone brings food. You're not allowed to have sex. You can't listen to music. You can't wear shoes. You don't leave the house for 7 days. You're depending on these other people. And then for the next 4 weeks, each week marked by each Sabbath is a separate kind of mourning that is differentiated by how you relate to your synagogue. On the first Sunday, you attend synagogue, but you wait outside for all of the songs of celebration. You don't sing those songs, you know, and basically every week, a little bit closer, you rejoin the community a little bit more every week. And then for the entire year after this person has died, you are saying the prayers of the mourner's Kaddish, and you are not allowed to say them alone. This is what I find so interesting. You are not permitted to say those prayers by yourself. You have to do it with a quorum of other people. And we don't have anything like that. You know, grief is just so highly individualized and privatized. And I think it's to our detriment.
Absolutely. That's true.
Yeah, and that folds in both for the community and their recognition to their stages that they're seeing as they participate along with you, as well as what you're talking about. There's that ritual space and a recognized, you know, status changes for you as well. So I love that as a great marriage. Mm. Terrific.
We could even bring back the mourner's bench if we just had a place, a space in our meeting for a when people sat there, we knew they were suffering. They were grieving. Not a word would have to be said, and people would know it's okay to talk to them about what their grief is.
So explain a little bit more about that. I've heard that, Lisa, but I've never really tried to visualize what that mourner's bench was. Was it for anybody in grief, or was it only in death? Is this anybody who felt like they should sit there that week?
I really don't know, but I have this romantic vision of it as you go to church and you see the people sitting there and you may not know what their grief is, or maybe you have an idea what it is and you are welcome to speak with them. You're welcome to make the connection. It's not going to be rejected if you offer something.
Oh, and so by sitting there, they're saying, I'm announcing this, but also I'm really calling on my community in some ways.
Exactly. Without having to stand up in testimony meeting and say, I'm still suffering, please help me. You have effectively communicated to your community that your mind, your emotions, your heart, your spirit is still focused on your loss, whatever that is.
What I would love to see in that is the people truly sitting on that bench. In today's culture, we're so proud, or we, of course, want to mourn in such a private way that how many would sit on that bench would be my question. I would love it if we could bring that back to where people felt comfortable to sit on that bench so we know. That would be an excellent.
Isn't it funny that it really is just a microcosm of what church is supposed to be anyway, a hospital for the sick. It should be that when we go to church, we're admitting that we need help and that we're appealing to the community of brothers and sisters to help us with a wide gamut of losses and travails. But we're equally proud about being in church. We want it to be that we're all finished, so look at me sit here in my pious.
Yep. very insightful.
I think of a Mormon funeral as funeral potatoes and green jello. That's how I sum it all up. And that is a crying shame, because we don't take it any further than those first 2 weeks.
Yeah, nothing formally, that's for sure. We have to kind of go after it ourselves if we're going to fold in our community after a certain point. You're right. Well, let's do this, and again, we'll focus on Mormonism and funerals, and I've got lots of things to prompt you guys on there. Lisa and Cindy, I'm going to call on you guys to kind of lead this next section, if you would. You both have some training in psychology and in grief work, and you've, either through clients, Lisa, I'm imagining mostly adult clients for you. Cindy, I'm imagining mostly children. I'd love to have any of you bring in theoretical framings that sort of, you know, I know there's Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's 5 stages, and I know that those were originally brought forth in terms of somebody facing their own imminent death, and they go through different things. But I know that those have been sort of, you know, put out there at least in broad strokes as pretty natural processes that you're pretty normal if these are processes that might be happening with you. But I don't know if she's your favorite framings for this or whatever, but I'd love to have one of you, you know, start off and kind of just talk to us about what is normal grieving, what is healthy grieving, and what can we expect?
I'm going to invite Cindy to do that because she's had the most recent training in that.
I'll do the schematics of it, and then I'm going to turn it over to Lisa, and she can get down to the behavior of the folks.
Okay. There's
different degrees. When a person dies, the first 2 weeks or the first month is the moment. It's just crisis intervention. The grief counseling begins about like after 3 months. And complicated grief or grief therapy is like a year after, and they just cannot quite handle life yet. Then you get the psychiatrist and the psychologist in on those. I've got a book here that I love. I do like Kubler-Ross. I think she's wonderful. This book I've got, I call my Bible, and it's by Dr. J. William Warden, and it's called Grief Counseling and Grief Therapy. He calls the stages that Kubler-Ross calls stages, he calls tasks. And I kind of like that word a little better because it's a task is more of something you just, a stage is like a passage. You have to go through a passage and then go to the other and the other. Tasks are more of, you do it. It doesn't matter how long you do your task or how short it is. They're just called tasks. And I like that word as a clinician. The first is to accept the reality of the loss. Denial is always something really important. And before I do this, I want to, the reason why these tasks are so important is because if we don't go through them, then one way or another, it usually will hit with depression. And this depression can go on into later in life and hit your relationship with your partner, your intimacy. These tasks, they feel like they really need to be accomplished and moved out of and go forward. And so they're very important to go through these tasks. The first one was to accept the reality, and the second one is to process the pain, and usually that, the pain of grief, that usually has anger in it, sadness. The third is to adjust to the world without the deceased, and he has just got external adjustments, living daily without the person, and B, internal adjustments, internal who am I, my self-esteem. How do I go about not being codependent on a person that I've relied on for so long? And see the spiritual adjustments. And of course, that has to do with your culture and your ideologies, your paradigms, what you believe in. The fourth one is to find an enduring connection with the deceased while you're embarking on a new life. And those steps or those tasks, they say that you really need to accomplish. And like I said before, there's different losses. There's your human and your pet loss, but there's also a symbolic loss. And that can be just as traumatic. And there's no normalcy to any of this. You can't say that one person does this normal and another person doesn't. You grieve on your own. You're done on your own. No one should tell you when or how and where the grieving should take place. He's got a lot of mediators that go along with these tasks. The first mediator is the kinship. Who died? Was it your husband, your wife, your sister, your brother, your grandmother? The second one is the nature of the attachment. How secure were you with the attachment? Were you codependent? Were you just, you know, did they live far away? Conflict and dependency issues, they're very important, that mediator. Mediator three is the death circumstances, and this is another real important one. The proximity of the death. Did you expect the death, or was it a trauma? Was it like the Colorado show house? Was it a death that was just uncalled for, or were you expecting this death? Also, the stigmatized deaths are like suicides or a person who, alcoholics. Those are, in our culture, that's really important because we tend to downplay, look down, or not know how to handle a suicide as compared to a grandmother who died. Then the mediator four is the historical. Your mental health history. Do you have maybe some bipolar in your family or depression? Does this compound this problem when you lose someone? The mediator five is the personality. The age and gender is very important. The age you are when the loss occurs, your gender. It seems like women with children who are divorced suffer more than a man. I don't know why that is. Lisa might be able to hit on that. The coping style, your insecure, your cognitive style, your ego, your strength, your self-esteem. Where does this all fit in this and your beliefs and your values? Are you going to see this person again? You know, those beliefs are very important. Then the mediator six is a social. And that's also important, and that's also involves your culture. Are you socially supported? are you after 6 months? Is someone still there for you in 3 weeks, in, you know, 3 months? What, how do we fit culturally with that? Your social roles, your religious and your ethnic backgrounds all make a difference. And the mediator seven is your concurrent stresses, the things that you have in your life at this time that cause you stress without having a loss that is on top of it, that can make it so much worse. And then, of course, we talk about the different feelings, the normal, what the clinicians, the psychologists, psychiatrists call normal. And you've got some physical, the hollowness in your stomach, the tightness in your chest, the tightness in your throat, your dry mouth, all of those things, your physical, your oversensitivity to noise, all of these things are so important when you first lose that special one. And then, of course, the feelings that you have and that you work through when you go through the grieving process. And I know I did that very, very quickly, but I want to leave Lisa some good time.
What you did there was wonderful in the sense that we have at least four tasks, and then we have all these mitigating factors that could come in play that absolutely spell to us there is nothing exactly normal about anybody. There's so many variables at play here, and therefore, you know, just because we got over it because of, you know, the alignment of the stars or our own lives or our relationships, we can't externalize and expect that everybody else would have the same sort of process.
That's right.
Thank you very much. Lisa, what would you throw in on top of that?
What's so interesting is that when we are experiencing grief, we don't automatically connect the dots between what's not working in our lives suddenly and the grief that we experienced. We tend to blame it on circumstances that have nothing to do with the death or the loss. For example, one common thing that happens to people after death is a loss of trust in people, institutions, beliefs that formerly gave comfort. And that loss of trust, we don't recognize that it goes along with the grief, that it's a product of grief. Irritability, for example, can happen to people who are experiencing a loss and they don't recognize that it's connected with grief. Some of the more common things we recognize as coming from grief, a desire to be left alone, for example. And what comes to mind with that is often people think, oh, if a person wants to be left alone, we need to cheer them up. We need to help them with that. And actually, the very best thing you can do is be with someone and honor that. I know that sounds ironic.
No,
but
yeah.
By honoring someone's desire to be, quote-unquote, left alone, you can actually be with them and be silent, and they may feel like they can endure someone's company. But if you're there trying to cheer them up, they will very much want you to leave them alone.
Wonderful. Keep going.
Well, perhaps the best thing to talk about at this point would be how we can help people that we know are experiencing grief. And that is really and truly by honoring whatever it is they say they're interested in doing or not doing, rather than trying to rock their boat or shake them up. Of course, the classic example we all think of is Job and his friends.
Yeah, the miserable comforters.
Exactly. And we know that people need others at that point, but we need others who are not trying to do anything. Does that make sense?
Totally.
People who aren't trying to do anything for us, they're just there with us. And that goes back to the Shiva that Jana was talking about a little while ago. People just sitting there on the stools, being there with us.
Mm-hmm.
We can do that for other people.
Those are all excellent. And when we get into the Mormon section, the personal section, maybe let's talk a little bit more about where we can do better and stuff like that. Back on just the normal processes of grief, either of you have more, or Jana, are there thoughts that occurred to you as you kind of talk about that larger, you know, here's processes, here are tasks?
Something occurred to me when Connie was speaking, I think it was Connie, about how if we don't deal with it, then it will find a way to come back and bite us. You know, there is an essay by George Orwell that I keep, this imagery I just keep coming back to, where he recounts having severed a wasp. He cuts the wasp in half at the breakfast table one day. The wasp was sucking jam on the plate. And George Orwell just, like, I don't know, as a nasty experiment, takes a knife and cuts him in half and says that the wasp actually didn't notice, paid no attention, went on eating, and he could see this little stream of jam kind of trickling out of the body. But it was only when the wasp tried to fly away that he grasped the dreadful thing that had happened to him. And, yeah, I find that a tremendously powerful image, that it's only when the wasp is attempting to move and do what wasps do that it can't. It realizes that it can't. And, you know, frankly, I feel like that a lot with grief. And what I think it was Lisa was saying about how sometimes the things that we're experiencing when we're grieving, irritability or physical symptoms, you know, I've been very surprised by how intensely physical this experience has been. Maybe we're not likely to put it down to the grief and to just try to keep pushing through it in a way that's not very healthy.
Yes, and another aspect that's actually quite common is the volatility of it. One moment you can be feeling just fine, going through what feels like a normal day, and the next moment,
yeah,
you're falling apart completely and you can't even find which direction is up.
Yeah.
That's a common experience in grief, and it can make people feel a little bit crazy, especially as it continues and a person experiencing grief says, when will this part end? Mm. When can I depend on myself as well as other people?
Wow. Jana, you shared in one of your posts about the gift shop at the museum. This speaks to Lisa's point.
Yeah.
Do you want to share that here? Do you mind?
No, I don't mind. I hope you don't mind if I start bawling. I'll try not to. But so it was a couple of weeks after my mom's death. It was Martin Luther King weekend, and my husband and daughter and I decided to go up to Columbus to the COSI Museum, which is the Columbus Museum of Science and Industry. And it was a really fun day, you know, considering everything that had happened. And also, I had gotten incredibly sick after the funeral. I had the flu. I had a fever of 102 for about 4 or 5 days. And, you know, it was just horrible. But we had this great day. And then at the end of the day at the museum, in the gift shop, I found this little book called Good Night iPad, which was charming. And it's a parody of Good Night Moon. I loved this book, you know. It's basically the grandmother's in her rocking chair, and all of the other creatures have their various devices, and she's trying to get them to put the devices away and, you know, quiet down. It's a wonderful book, and I was laughing in the store, and then I thought, oh, I can't wait, you know, to tell my mom about this book. And then it was like somebody just punched me in the stomach. It was so physical. I felt like I wanted to just double over. I'll never call her again.
Now, Jana, maybe this will take you a little bit away from it. Was it in the museum that you met the fellow who has now started to send you regularly pamphlets?
No. Okay.
Oh, that was later. Okay. I'm tying those in my head when I shouldn't.
No, it's okay. At the end of February, I went to upstate New York to do a speaking engagement, and it was this entire Episcopal diocese had chosen Flunking Sainthood as its one book, one diocese book for Lent. And so they had, I think, 19 out of their 24 congregations in the diocese were all reading Flunking Sainthood, and then they had me come to speak, and I led a clergy quiet day for the priests in the diocese, and then an open event in the evening. And in between those things, I had a conversation with one of the priests. And, you know, I told them right at the outset, this is my first speaking engagement since my mother's death. They're all pastors, you know, they know how to deal with death. And so I was talking with one of them afterward, and he was incredibly kind. And then in the mail that week, I had the first of these pamphlets that he's been sending me, and they're designed. They're by this guy named Kenneth Hauk, H-A-U-G-K. They're very short, which is about all I was able to to do, you know, to walk you through the process of the immediate aftermath, the 3-month mark, the 6-month mark, the 9-month mark, and the 1-year mark. It's a whole series of these pamphlets, and they are very helpful. Some of the things that I've been experiencing, they seem like they can't possibly be normal. And so it is somehow affirming to look and read about other people's experiences. I mean, like Lisa said, you sometimes think you're going crazy. And this is not who I normally am. When will I return to the person that I think myself to be?
Another crazy thing that people in grief do, and that I found myself doing, is along the lines of Janice's story, and that is keeping things going that I think my mom would like, or that I imagine someday, and this isn't even a conscious thought, it's just an undercurrent, and suddenly I'll recognize I'm keeping something going because when mom comes back, she will approve. And it makes no sense because she's not coming back, but I can't stop doing it, like watering her plants, or keeping her desk just so, or keeping her greeting cards all in a row in a particular way. It's kind of a grief ritual that actually makes no sense when I think of why I'm doing it, but it's very comforting.
Yeah,
there's no right way or wrong way.
You know, one piece of it that we haven't mentioned that I'm guessing is in the literature is at a certain point, you know, where, you know, it's probably every other thought for a while is of this person, and then it begins to fade, and then maybe you recognize that a few days have gone by and you really hadn't thought of it. And is that, then there's a layer of guilt that comes on, like, oh, I'm tell us about anybody that can reflect on the normalcy or how to feel better about the fact that at some point it's healthy that they are not occupying quite that conscience spot.
It's healthy to go through any of these feelings. The sadness, the anger, the guilt, the anxiety, the loneliness, the fatigue, the helplessness, shock, yearning. All of those things are so normal. And the numbness, you know. And when a person, you know, I go back to my mother all the time when we're talking about these things.
She's still living.
My mother is still living, yes.
It's our mother.
Yes, our mother is still living. However, when she was 12, she lost her mother. When she was 13, she lost her father. When she was 16, she married a wonderful man of 21. And lost her husband a year after, but she was married to him for 2 years because she had me, and I was about two, almost two. Then, about 6 months later, she lost her brother. He was coming back from the military, and his plane crashed over the Colorado Mountains with some other folks. It was a real tragedy. But anyway, then about 8 years after that, she lost her sister in a terrible convertible accident where the convertible went under a semi-truck, and she could not even be recognized. Then just recently, what, about a year ago, 2 years ago, she lost our dad 5 years ago, and then she had remarried, and she had divorced Connie's dad, and anyway, remarried and lost him 2 years ago. So in other words, she has lost probably about seven very beloved folks in her life. And I watched her go through this last one, and the first thing she did is she moved. She literally packed up and said, I bought a house in St. George. She lived in Payson all of her life, and she moved to St. George. And I can still see when she comes up, the pain coming through, because she'll come up and she'll go to the house. She'll come down to my house. She'll be anxious. She'll start crying. She goes, I don't know why I'm crying. I'm so depressed. And I'm going, Mom, you've got to let this pain out. You've got to let it go. You've got to let it flow. And she just, and that is so natural to try to run away. That's one of the things that is just human nature. She's had 60 years of grief, and she's an incredible woman. I look to her, and she's so on the ball and so feisty, and she's getting along fine under the circumstances. I think she's doing well.
But she needs to let it out, is what you're saying.
Yes, she does. She needs to let this pain out, and
be allowed to mourn her tremendous loss.
She has not ever done that. She's not ever completely let loose. Even when she lost her husband, she was only 18 when she lost her husband, and she said, "I never grieved over him. I never had support. My mom and dad were dead. My brother was dead. I didn't have the support I needed, and the social support she didn't have. So, and you can tell it's made a difference in her life." Even today, it's made a difference.
Thank you for sharing that. Tragic, but instructive. Thank you. Oh, crud. Cindy, before we let you take too big a break, can you talk a little bit about children, youngsters, the convention, the best wisdom that's out there in terms of how much to share? You know, do you lie to them? You know, I mean, you know, do you mention, well, Grandpa's on a long trip, or you know, give us some guidelines there, or whatever.
That's an exact quote in my book. An exact
really?
Quote.
Oh, wow.
Long trip, yes. That's the what not to say. Toddlers, they have an understanding of death in that they cannot tell a difference between an absence, reality. They're still struggling. But when you get up into the ages of like between like 6 and 9, these children are going to ask questions. And if they're smart enough to ask the question, then you give them the proper answer and you be as truthful as you can and say just as much as you need to say and no more. These children are asking, and you need to reply things like, they've gone on a long trip, he's in a better place, Jesus needed him up there more than we did, the angels took him away. Those kinds of things are very inappropriate. And they can, if you're thinking like a little child and you just found out that Jesus needed him more than you, how's that going to make you feel? I mean, I would really not like Jesus very much because he took my mother away. So you need to be very careful in what you say and be very truthful and honest and use the words death and dying.
So Cindy, should we use euphemisms as much as we do anyway, or is it just with children, or always are we over dependent on euphemisms and don't say death or dying?
No, we do. We need to just say your father has died. Not, oh, he's living in a better place. He's, you know, we sprinkled him over here, and you know, you've got to be really truthful with children. And as they get older, of course, you get into the teens, and they can carry a lot of guilt. So you've got to, and they're so susceptible to drugs, casual sex, alcohol, smoking. When things like this happen, they turn to those kinds of things. And the social pressure is immense. They don't want to be abnormal, so to speak. So they don't want to show any signs of, my dad died. No, I'm not going to go there. I'm going to be normal like all the rest of my classmates and pretend it didn't happen. So you've got some very vulnerable spots when you get into the teenage years. But just remember that children they'll be very curious, and they'll ask the questions. And just remember in your mind that if they're smart enough to ask a question, you give them the right answer.
Yeah, I think that's great advice. Others with thoughts? Lisa, anything in your counseling lit or experience?
You bet. For any of us that can't process our grief with words, we will find ourselves acting it out. And that's true whether we're talking about a child who suddenly begins bedwetting, or a normally obedient child who becomes defiant, or a teenager who stops talking and who stays in his room, or an adult who finds him or herself starting to take risks that wouldn't normally be taken. All of those can be legitimate symptoms of grief that's unprocessed. When my mother passed away, it was a double loss for me, because I had to start dealing with my father's advancing dementia full time. And so I had the loss of really both of my parents at the same time. And I also felt some guilt about my mother's death, because hers was from a stroke. And if she'd been taken to the hospital a number of hours earlier, they could have administered something that they administer to people who have a stroke that can preserve some brain function. And because I hadn't gone over to her home on the Friday night where she actually experienced the stroke, if I had been there, I would have seen that she was having trouble speaking, but didn't find out about it until the following morning. I felt some guilt about that. And then I was called upon to make some decisions about what kind of care she should have and whether we should take some measures that would preserve her life while her brain was swelling, and then what kind of decisions that would might maybe allow her to have a quality of life after, and how long we should keep trying to keep her alive and clear her lungs so that she had a chance. Just all of these decisions that I had to make. I second-guessed myself every minute about all of those. And so 2 weeks later, when she finally passed and we made the decision to let her go, I was filled with questions, and these complicated my grief so that I couldn't just allow my mom to go. I wanted her back. I wanted to have the chance to make some of those decisions again. And those did some of the very same. I needed a chance to process those in addition to what you might call the regular grief. I was seeing a counselor at the time, and he said to me after, 4 weeks after my mom had passed, he said, "Have you gone up in the mountains and screamed at God yet? You really need to do that. You may never process your grief unless you have a chance to do that." And that surprised me. You mean I have to yell at God? I have to process it in expressing it that way? And my counselor said, "Yeah, actually, you better be about that."
Fascinating. Do you want to share if you did?
Actually, from that day to this, till my dad died just a week ago today, I've been caretaking him, and it has delayed my grief.
Mm-hmm.
I am still looking forward to that day. I hope it's not in the too distant future where I go up in the mountains and scream for a while.
Yeah. And the at God and just at the universe and just this circumstances is so important. And you know, we've done Mormon Matters podcasts on the problem of evil and suffering and things like that. And it's fascinating that Mormonism at least has this wonderful resource within it of, you know, when Enoch confronts God and they see the evil in the world, we have a God who is weeping and is not making excuses. And it's basically saying, this is a tragic universe that I'm overseeing, you know, but I can't control it all. And he doesn't say I do it for the greater good. And he's not doing all the typical theodicy stuff. Sometimes it's just grief and weeping. Yeah. And just noting it. And, you know, and then there's that beautiful moment when he gives Enoch a picture of it. Enoch says, "My heart swelled as wide as eternity." And he basically got the glimpse of what it was, what the job description of God is, at least in the Mormon conception as it is. And I just like that. And so when you talk about that your person is telling you about screaming at God and stuff, all that just works to me, because that's exactly God's reaction to, it seems to me. And so it's not blasphemous or anything outside something healthy.
Yes, Yeah, it's a healthy way of processing things that have no answer.
Right. Yes, yes.
You know, one thing that I've noticed, and hearing Lisa talk has kind of reminded me of this, is that the phrase, mourn with those who mourn, has come home to me in a new way, not just as a recipient of other people's deep sympathy, which I greatly appreciate, but also the sense of that my heart has been carved out in ways I didn't know before. So Lisa and I don't actually know each other. We've never met, but her brother is my bishop and has been for like 6 years. He's an absolutely wonderful man. And in the fall, when I had a conversation with him when I just found out that my mom had been diagnosed with cancer. She was diagnosed on the 1st of November. So in, I guess it was November or maybe late October, your mother had died, right, Lisa? When did she pass away?
October 11th.
Oh, okay. Earlier than I thought, October 11th. And he was telling me, you know, that he'd lost his mother. And then I found out on Sunday about your dad, and it was, you know, so totally unexpected. Dan had already contacted all of us to ask about this podcast. And then on Sunday, I had a potluck here at the house for people in the ward. And I had asked someone, oh, you know, where's the bishop? Because his wife was here. And then Carolyn said, oh, didn't you know his dad died? And I just couldn't believe it. And I feel, I don't know, I feel it's someone I've never met before, but I'm so sorry for you to lose both of your parents within such quick succession. And also, the bishop had gotten up in church just the week before. We'd had an all-ward kind of strategizing meeting to talk about reactivating people and things like that. And he opened the meeting in a really beautiful way by sharing the stories of when you guys were kids growing up in Indianapolis and how instrumental your father was in building the church there, and that he chose to move there, that he had other opportunities. He could have stayed in Utah, but he really wanted to be part of this kind of pioneering experiment of building Zion elsewhere. And, you know, I was very moved by that. And then, you know, to find out that he'd passed away, I'm so sorry.
And as you mentioned, just one brief insight into his life, and then connect it with his death, I feel something really beautiful grow inside me. It's a marvelous way of connecting with my grief to memorialize just one incident. It's powerful.
You know, you mentioned in your email yesterday that you guys had a really unusual Mormon funeral. I'd like to hear more about that. Would that be a good time, Dan?
Yeah, let's transition into that section about, yeah, we can kind of talk about what a typical Mormon funeral is, but Lisa, tell us what you guys did that was wonderful.
Well, I'm not so sure that my father would think it was wonderful.
Oh,
was,
you guys did, but not him.
He was quite adamant that a funeral was not to eulogize a person, but was to preach the gospel. That was, I'm sure I've heard him say that at least 3 or 4 dozen times during my life, before and after every funeral or death he ever talked about. So at his death, we were in kind of a quandary. Because he'd lived most of his life in Indianapolis, we decided we wanted to have the official funeral in Indianapolis, and that has not happened yet. But because he and my mother lived here for the past 2.5 years, when my mother passed, we buried her near my town of Payson, where I'm living now, so that my father could visit her grave. So we decided to have him buried in Payson, of course, next to her, but the funeral would be in Indianapolis. We didn't want to bury him unceremonialized, if that's a word. So we decided to have what we called a memorial service, but we termed it family home evening type memorial service. And we held it in the mortuary, I think, which my father would never have approved of, because we wanted to be able to do things in an unconventional way. And we simply opened the meeting with a song, and then we invited people to make music or to speak something they learned from my father. And we just let the meeting go as maybe people were moved. So there was nothing more formal to it than that. And we had people do musical numbers. We had people get up and speak something they'd shared with or about my father. And the meeting lasted probably no more than an hour because it was more well attended than I had anticipated. And I wanted people not to feel like they had to stay. But it was a very different feel from a funeral.
Awesome. I liked it a lot.
So really, it was somewhat more of a wake, which is generally more instructive, but without the alcohol, but certainly with the unexpectedness of how someone is prompted might rise up.
Yes, it was unexpected. Of course, there was no printed program. And something Connie said afterward was that as someone in the audience, she felt that it helped her feel like on the edge of connection rather than as a passive experience, as someone whose participation was called for, whether or not she was going to get up and say anything. It was her connection to my father that was the meat of the meeting, whether she said anything or not. And she said she thought she felt other people there felt the same way, so that each person there had a connection with the person who was being talked about rather than just experiencing the program the family put together.
Connie, do you want to say anything more about that?
Yeah, I think I spoke to it a little earlier that I think at death, the word is memorialize, and that means that you venerate the person who's passed on. And to be passive in that is, it feels like an exclusion. It feels like you don't get a chance to connect or to celebrate your part of that person's life. And no matter the best planned funeral, it's a mere slice of that person's total mortal experience. And it's from one perspective, or, you know, limited perspective of people generally who bear a title. You know, this was husband, wife, son, family, friend, but it's so shallow compared to the depth and the abundance of a person's life. I, not only in getting the opportunity to express my connection, which was a way for me to deal with the grief, to say, I have a reason to cry. Here's the reasons this person was important to me. Here's the connections I experienced, and these are things that will never happen again. And that's a grief that maybe isn't so often acknowledged, but it also was fascinating to hear other people's experience and to learn things truly about this person that I may have never known otherwise.
And you know, something like that also is a way that other people can carry the burden for the family. You know, when we had my mother's funeral just a few days after her death, and her pastor, who was one of her closest friends, you know, knew her incredibly well as anybody, and he gave a beautiful eulogy, and it was like a vicarious ordinance. I don't know how to express it, but, and all of the things that people said about her, not in the funeral, which was a pretty traditional Lutheran liturgy, very liturgical, high church, but elsewhere to me later and in notes and cards, all of those memories and having a record of them has been so important to me, because yeah. I wanted to say something at my mother's funeral. And in fact, when I met with Tom, the pastor, right after Mom passed away, I said, yes, I'd like to write a little something about her generosity. That she was one of, you know, the things about my mother that I most admire. And, you know, she was very well known in our small community in Illinois for that and for her activism. I couldn't do it. I mean, those days after the death, I just couldn't muster up anything else. And so when the funeral happened, I just went. I attended the funeral and I grieved, and other people carried that burden, and that was very important.
Gorgeous. A couple things that can fold in pretty easily in the Mormon format. Maybe we'll talk about, maybe we'll outline what the typical Mormon funeral is and see if we can then do it. But quickly, what you just said, I have been at the ones where there's cards and things right there. Please write stories for us. You know, so sometimes while you're sitting there after the viewing and you're waiting for there, it was fun to be able to share some stories in cards. So that's at least one way to do it. And then I went to a funeral that was quite interesting, very traditional within the church. Then you go to the dedication of the grave at the cemetery. But, you know, there's a little microphone there generally with the speaker system. And after the dedication of the grave, they just invited anybody to come up and share at the microphone. And we got that whole spontaneous, you know, I drove here from California because she was such an influence in my life or something like that, that again, wasn't part of the funeral, but it still fit. Nobody felt like, oh, we're transgressing Mormon, you know, stuff here.
Mm-hmm. And yet it's so enriching just to have those details. It makes all the difference.
Totally. Hey, right now, listeners, Jana Reese has to drop off the call. And so, Jana, thank you very much for all you've shared online with us today, the broader perspectives you brought. Is there anything, you know, maybe we're kind of in a section on good practices. Is there anything else that you've seen or heard that has made a difference for you, or you think it would have made a difference for you? Anything that you want to offer in closing before you take off?
I like the idea of tasks. Was it Connie that was talking about those?
No, you're mixing up Cindy and Connie.
That was Cindy. Okay. Yes, the idea of tasks. And I was thinking, just in the last month, we went to Hawaii, and my mother loved to travel, wasn't able to travel too much in the last few years, but the last big trip that we had all taken, she came with us, and that was to Alaska. And so during the Hawaii trip, I was thinking often of how much she would have loved it. And I think that one of my tasks, as I remember her and honor her in the years to come, is to travel. And to just go around the world and think of my mother and to meet interesting people and learn about history and love the things that she would have loved. And another thing that happened today is that I found out, to my great delight, that one of my mother's best friends is running for the state legislature in Illinois. And I can honor my mother by supporting her friend. I mean, there are all kinds of ways to honor my mother in my life.
Neat.
Yeah,
and thank you all so much for letting me be part of this conversation. It's been therapy. I feel like I should pay you.
Oh, what a privilege for us to be with
you. Thank you, Jana.
Yeah, thank you, Jana. This is, I know, a very tender time, and you've been such a gift to us. So thank you for everything you've done.
Thank you all. Good night.
Good night.
Good night.
Okay, so here's my riff on what a normal Mormon funeral is. And, you know, obviously the first choice is whether or not you're going to have it in the chapel. And when you have it in the chapel, my understanding is there's pretty strict rules that you need to have a bishopric member, unless you really ask for exceptions. It has to be somebody there who conducts it. And, you know, you know typically, is your understanding is it's in the handbook that at some point in the funeral, if you're going to be in there, the plan of salvation has to be talked about and testified to?
Yes.
And I've had friends who've had their funerals outside the church for that very reason, because of their wider circle of acquaintances who are not LDS, who they didn't want to bring into the chapel and have them, you know, feel like, well, somebody is now just taking the chance to proselytize me or something like that. And so, but the typical Mormon funeral, certainly it seems to me there's a welcome, you know, there's the viewing in the Relief Society room, perhaps the night before, as well as, you know, the half hour or the hour before the funeral. Then the family meets together, closes the doors, kind of a family prayer, and then closes the casket. Typically, the person, if they've been endowed or in their temple, close. And so that's the first time for many people to ever experience that in person to see what it is. But, you know, usually closing, perhaps something is, you know, put in the casket and things like that, seems like a pretty normal thing. So the prayer happens, and then everybody files in, and then, or they fall in the casket that's brought up to the front, and then the funeral begins. And it seems to me after the opening stuff, it's always a sketch of the life. Is that what you guys would say is the typical pattern? the reading of the obituary or perhaps something more spontaneous and sort of an encapsulation. And then it's usually just one or two family members or good friends that share. You might get some humor. Do you guys sense that humor is frowned upon in Mormon funerals or welcomed?
Well, you know, my husband had to speak at a funeral where the man had committed suicide. And he was so distraught and worried about what he was going to say. It was one of his dear friends from high school. And so the mother had called my husband and asked if he would speak. And he said, "What do I do?" And I said, "You know, I think we ought to dwell on nothing but all of the fun things he did and not even touch the suicide or even go near that road." So he got up and he talked, and there were a lot of people in there that they weren't churchgoers in the chapel. They were Mormons, but they didn't actually attend. So he, when he went to do his talk, he just did nothing but humorous and had them laughing, and the mother was literally crying. She was laughing so hard. And when the funeral was over with, they went up and just hugged my husband and said, "You do not know what a refreshing thing that was that you have done for us." And it made a world of difference. So I think humor needs to be in funerals.
Sacrament room chapels. What do you call the chapel? The chapel, when you have a funeral in the chapel, I think when families are conducting it or family members or grandchildren speak, humor is so important for the family to experience. But when you have the funeral in the tabernacle, I don't think the humor plays a large part.
So typically then it does seem like there's an ecclesiastical leader at some point. You know, obviously there's some musical numbers that typically are in there, the grandkids, somebody with special talents, a close friend or whatever would do it. The ecclesiastical leader seems to be under instructions of certain amount of plan of salvation, a little bit of gospel hope and whatnot. And then the typical close of the funeral would be a prayer and whatnot. The pallbearers come up, take the casket out to the hearse and head over to the cemetery. And there at the cemetery, you basically gather under a canopy and surrounding it and things like that for the priesthood ordinance of the dedication of the grave, final resting place, place of protection. Hopefully it'll be a place of peace and comfort to those who come and remember the person here at the gravesite. And Relief Society is generally waiting back there for you at the chapel, where a family dinner is there, and that's where, who was it that brought up the funeral potatoes and the Jello? That's pretty typical there. But that's a nice piece of service that generally is good for family and close friends. Kind of a self-selected group typically goes back and enjoys that. But there's very little at a house, you know, where there is the gathering and the more informal things and whatnot within Mormonism. Have I basically laid out the typical structure?
You covered it well.
Okay. Now, have any of you been to a Mormon funeral where the person has chosen cremation?
It wasn't Mormon.
Okay.
But I tell you, it was an eye-opener to me. I couldn't quite take my eyes off that. What are they called? Urns?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I was young. I was really young. I'd had maybe two kids, and the funeral was in Connecticut. And I can just remember it was very hard for my husband to finalize his death because he couldn't sing. So he had a hard time believing that he had really passed on. It took him quite a while, quite a long time. Every time the phone would ring, he'd say to me, "You know what? I think Mitch is still alive, and that he just made this up so he doesn't have to come home. I still think he's in Mexico. And every time that phone would ring, he would think it might be Mitch. And it was sad to watch, but I've never experienced something like that. And it was an eye-opener, and I liked it.
And you liked it. Okay, so
I did.
So you weren't making an argument, because I've heard that argument against cremation as, you know, somehow the finalization of seeing a body, you know, a recognized body with lifeless and things like that helps with closure. It sounded like you were going that direction, but on the other hand, you kind of said that it was also...
Well, for me, it was closure. I wasn't that close to Mitch, but for my husband, it was not. And he had a very hard time with it. So the closer you are to the people, that might be a real problem. I don't know. I don't know.
Well, in some cultures where cremation is the norm, it's common. There are also opportunities for the family to come see the cremated remains and pick and choose portions that remain to be part of their memorial. And so they actually do get to participate in the tangible remains, even if they're cremated.
I bet Connie's got lots of examples of practices like that. But I don't know, you're welcome to share anything if you'd like. But just in Mormon culture, just to let everyone know, it's absolutely not against the gospel to choose cremation. I know that I'm planning on that, and it's been written and well-circulated within my family, so no one's second-guessing Lori if I go before her, and everyone's kind of made peace with that. But I'm not for embalming. I'm not for anything other than, you know, I'm fine being ashes. So, but again, people coming to the crematorium, you know, any of that stuff is certainly up to them and things like that. But so things that vary, we kind of mentioned some things that could be folded into LDS funerals. In the Polynesian one, it did seem like, if I'm remembering right, they talked about, you know, the funeral is maybe people start showing up at 9, you know, instead of the typical 11 or whatever. And it seems like within these cultures is almost like a designated person that begins these songs of lament, and it could go on. And in fact, sometimes they're basically saying the priesthood leadership who's at the LDS funeral are not in control at all. It's the oldest sister who's sort of in the family that kind of does it. And you know, the funeral could have been designated to start at 11, and it might be at 1 or 2 in the afternoon or something before they sort of give the go-ahead that this process of letting out some emotion, you know, does it. So in other words, it's a nice cultural layer. What have you guys seen, or what do you think could be some possibilities for adding a little more opportunities for different kinds of grief to be expressed at funerals?
I think the locality is really key. I'd be interested in the story that you said. So this early gathering and even the official ceremony itself took place in church?
Yeah, it was in the, I'm going off memory. I should have re-listened, but it was fascinating to hear, and it kind of made me think, you know, this is something that feels healthier to me, though I know it would frustrate a lot of people too to not be able to, you know, schedule their day, if, you know, in the middle of the week or whatever. But it still was a pretty neat thing that, you know, obviously LDS culture in West Valley, Utah, where, you know, there's lots of Polynesian families, this is something that they've become accustomed to, I guess.
I can't help but think how closely tied that is to birth and the way we've institutionalized birth, when, you know, only certain people participate. It's even now, it's quite often scheduled. It takes place in this very special place. And I think, what a shame that we've taken the reality out of a very natural step in the circle. You know, birth and death. I think it's wonderful that it's put in the hands of the people for whom it's most important. It's always disconcerting to me to have a priesthood leader with perhaps very little experience and relationship with the deceased be the one who has the final say and to control and to construct this experience. That's always troubling to me, as is the formality that you've described.
Do you guys feel that it would be a stigmatized funeral if the ward were basically invited to the largest congregating area in a funeral home versus the chapel? Would there be talk and tongues waggling about why they chose not to do it in the chapel?
I've always wondered about that too, but that's certainly my intent, because I hope my life reflects my love of the gospel, but I don't want my whole life to be encompassed in the chapel. And so many things that are vital parts of my life and my interest, or my husband's, we could say, you know, he's a trumpet player and wants a brass ensemble, and I want to have world drumming, a circle of drums. All those things just are not compatible with what we envision taking place in the chapel. And I don't know. If it's good weather, I hope that we can have it at the cemetery itself or maybe the city park, but I feel like it needs to be more a reflection of the person's actual mortality, which is not spent 24/7 in the pews of the chapel.
Others, any thoughts?
Hope Cindy's taking notes of that.
There you go. Way to go, Connie.
Well, Connie said she wants to be cremated, and I haven't come to grips with that yet. I have a hard time in death. If it's a close death, I think I'd act just like my husband. I would need to see that finalization before I would accept. It would be very hard for me.
And I think part of my perspective is painted by being on excavations, by actually excavating the remains of people hundreds or less years passed on. And I think there's nothing more
invasive.
We have the impression that if we're dressed nicely and we're put in a velvet case and we have a firm latch on the box, and then it's put in a concrete vault and then it's lowered and we have pretty green grass and flowers growing on it, that everything beneath the ground is pretty and you know, carried on the way that we have the picture in our mind, and it's so not like that. But it, to me, it's much more final to say, I got to see the decomposition of that body. I got to see, or I see the final dust. It's so much gentler and more within, more dignified, yeah, and better closure, because I got to see really the dust to dust, as opposed to the ugly aspects that actually take place within the body, within the vault, within the casket.
Mm-hmm. One thing, I think many listeners know, I'm working on a project to write a biography of Eugene England's life, and it was interesting that his family's choices were, now of course Gene, it was known in advance, so this is probably something that couldn't happen, you know, on the sudden deaths, the you know, the traumas and the instant things, but you know, in the months leading up to it, sons built a pine box, you know, coated it. I think one of them even forged the handles himself. The grandchildren decorated the inside of it. And Gene was laid to rest within 24 hours. They didn't want to have him embalmed. And so when the time came and the day after it, they laid him to rest. And, you know, they had just a family service and things like that. And then they were able to take their time. And eventually they had a funeral that took place in the Provo Tabernacle. You know, for a very public life like Gene's, that was something they were able to do. But just that whole idea of, again, if the embalming phase, which does seem to me to be, you know, a bit of craziness, that seems like another option besides the cremation thing, especially if it's something you can plan for in advance. So just throw that out there, and I'm sure there's plenty of others. And invite listeners, please, to share your rituals, your plans, anything that you know can kind of feed our discussion and open up possibilities for us for that particular part of the death and dying process, as well as, you know, facilitating good grief and the true processes and accomplishing the tasks.
Well, here's something I didn't know until my father's death, and that is that it's what I used to think was that if you didn't have a body embalmed, it had to be buried within a certain amount of time. But the fact is, the body can also be refrigerated. if it's not embalmed. And so it gives the family a lot more options for when they want to do what. If they don't want to have the body embalmed, there's no law that says they have to.
Okay, well, that's good news for me, and I'm not sure. Is that fairly recent, do you think? Because I thought that it was the 24-hour rule, at least in Utah, but I guess it's not.
We didn't have my father embalmed, and I was worried about that. I thought maybe he would have to be buried right away, and the mortuary assured me, no, as long as we keep him refrigerated, we can keep him here for a long, long time. We just have to keep him refrigerated.
Okay, well, interesting. Well, lots of options. Other thoughts, just in closing, did you all pretty much share the things that you wanted to share, or is there a spot now to throw in anything left over?
Just how enjoyable this whole conversation has been in the various aspects and the opportunity to share ideas and perspectives. It's been really, really rewarding for me personally.
Thank you, Connie. Loved having you. Thanks for everything that you taught us. Cindy or Lisa?
This is a new experience for me. It was really quite nice. I do need to correct something, though.
Please.
I'm a mental health worker for the Red Cross. For the school district, all I do is just help teach in the specialized preschool. But I'm hopefully going to be able to quit that job and go on to my master's. So I just needed to clarify.
Okay, so I got it wrong. So I apologize for that. So thanks for that. But anything else, Lisa, in closing?
We didn't talk much about something that often occurs in grief, and that is the bargaining parts of our personality that come out when we recognize that someone's death is imminent or we want to mitigate the effects of loss. One of the ways we cope with that is by making promises or deciding that there's something that we can change about our life that we think would make a difference, or offering a trade. I don't think we touched on that, and yet that seems to be a universal
bargaining with God.
Impulse,
yes,
yeah.
Kubler-Ross talked about that as a stage, and although it's not mentioned as a task, it certainly does seem to be something that many people do experience. It's one of the creative parts of grief is to say, I will give this if I can just avoid this.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if the others wanted to comment on that.
Interesting. That's kind of fits in the deathbed aspect. It's that moment of realization that something's imminent. You begin to, and in various cultures, the response would be different.
Thank you. Yeah, Lisa, thank you, because that definitely is in the Kubler-Ross. But and folks who are listening, I'm sure we left out lots more. So we're not going to feel bad if you say, please, this is something you left out, and then prompt either by talking about yourself or ask for somebody to weigh in on the website blog. So thank you for that. Anything else, Lise?
Nope, that's good.
Okay, Cindy?
Yeah, thank you.
Okay.
No, that's fine. Thanks.
Well, thank you. I've enjoyed this too. I felt like we did a really thorough look at, you know, in broad strokes at the things that we needed to today, some practical examples. Thank you, Lisa, for being on, especially at this extremely tender time. Jana, of course, we've already said goodbye to, and we thank her again for sharing so much of herself with us. Folks, please come to the blog, mormonmatters.org, after this is up. Hopefully you'll listen to the podcast and then share your experiences and fill in holes and ask questions and all that stuff. We'd love the conversation mostly take place there rather than on Facebook, as it's a much more permanent kind of record, and the blog will be around for a long, long time. So please come to the blog. While you're there at the website, there's always a donate button in that upper right-hand corner, and we love any time you click that or sign up to become a subscriber on a regular basis and things like that. It really helps the podcast keep going and allows me to have that freedom to spend all this, all the different times, you know, setting things up, recording, and then the post-production is a big thing too. So thank you for all you do and all the letters and the notes and the things that you share. And even when you yell at us, that's appreciated too. It's great to have feedback. So thank you.
Thank you for sponsoring this, Dan. making it happen.
It's a pleasure. It's been a real blessing in my life. So I hope it continues to be something that connects with people out there. So anyway, wish you all good night and say thanks again.
Good night. Good night.
Thanks. Cue the music.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Matters Podcast. To discuss this podcast with others, please check us out at mormonmatters.org. To keep this podcast alive, or to join our support community, please consider a tax-deductible donation today at mormonmatters.org. Music for this podcast was brought to you by Brittany and Clayton Pixton. The Mormon Matters logo was generously provided by StudioCase.com. Thank you for listening.